Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, this November 29th, 2013, day after Thanksgiving. I hope all of you out there had a terrific holiday, perhaps got together with friends, family, had a good meal, and gave time to consider what we really have to be thankful for. I know that times are not easy for a lot of folks, but there's still much that we need to take solace and comfort from, and especially the fact that we can all, as Americans, pull together and do what's really essential to perhaps give the politicians a kick in the pants and get them to do what's necessary for them to do so they can actually do something that seems to be increasingly hard to find. That is to say, represent us, we the people of the United States. So, again, great joining you this Friday evening, as I do at the end of every week, to play that game of catch-up with you and report on the lunacy that seems to pass for normalcy these days. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Worked for that agency for about 30 years. But if you want to read more about me, find out more about what I've been up to and why I do this radio program, I would ask that you please visit my website, and that is michaelcutler.net, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. Also, I am a senior fellow with a terrific organization in Californians, known as Californians for Population Stabilization, and their great website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. They are located, as they like to remind me, in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, on the West Coast, where especially this time of year, that climate seems all the more inviting. And here I sit on the East Coast, not quite as warm, not by nearly enough, but nevertheless, we've got the country bracketed. They're on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. Have a lot of good friends out there in Santa Barbara, in California. Hope they're listening this evening, and I'm glad that you folks all are. Let me get started by telling you that I just wrote an article for CAPS, in fact, and I expect that the way that they operate, it should be up within a matter of a day or two, really quite quickly. They do a great job of putting up not only my article, but the articles of a lot of writers who are trying to really provide perspective on just how screwed up things are and what needs to really be done to protect the United States. And my contribution for their website is limited to the immigration issue. That's wherein I have my expertise. And, you know, I was admonished by my parents growing up as they would tell me at the dinner table if I started to make statements that I couldn't substantiate. My dad would give me that father look, as I've come to call it, and he'd say, "Mike, empty barrels make a lot of noise." Well, I'm not an empty barrel, and we're not trying to make noise, but I am trying to get your attention. So the title for my article that I just finished writing today is called, "If You Like Your Job, You Can Keep It, Not." And, of course, you could probably figure this out. I was bouncing my commentary off of what we've been seeing with the supposed Affordable Care Act. I don't know who it's supposed to be affordable for. Of course, it goes by that other moniker, that other nickname, Obamacare. And, you know, we heard so much about how, well, if you like your doctor, you can keep it. If you like your insurance, you can keep it. Not so much. And this isn't going to be a conversation about Obamacare, but what this is going to be is a discussion about the failings of the government, and it's happening across a broad spectrum of issues, and it's affecting us profoundly. And you know, and this isn't a partisan issue. I make no bones about it. I've been registered as a Democrat ever since I cast my first ballot. I hate to admit it's been more than 40 years ago. But I don't know what happened to either party. I did a speaking event not very long ago on a college campus, and somebody said to me, "Mike, how in the world do we solve all the problems that we're facing when you realize that we're being hammered from every which direction?" And I said, "Well, really, if you could resolve just two issues in America today, I think that most of the other problems would take care of themselves. You're probably sitting on the edge of your chair wondering what tuition is, so I'll tell you. It's political campaign finance, the contributions, which all too often have become nothing more than legalized bribes, and it's the political parties, both parties. You cannot be a slave to two masters. There is no way that a political representative can represent his or her constituents without running afoul of the leadership of the respective parties to which they belong. That's just a statement of fact. And so pity the poor congressman or congresswoman or whoever who runs for elected office, wants to do the right thing, and suddenly finds out that by representing their constituents, they're going to anger the people that they depend upon for campaign contributions and party and committee assignments, you know, because the committee assignments are determined by the political party, whether we're talking about Democrats or Republicans. So understand how beholden the politicians are to their parties. How in the world can you be beholden to your party on the one hand and keep the promises you made to your constituents on the other hand? Many times people have said to me, Mike Cutler, why don't you run for Congress? And I have a simple answer. I don't run for Congress. I run from Congress. I don't want to imagine what that hellish situation is like. And I have some friends on the Hill who I think are amazing. I think they're really trying to do the right thing. We could talk about Lou Barletta. We could talk about Jeff Sessions. There's a bunch of people who I think are truly committed to doing what's right. On the other side of it, I can't even imagine the squeeze play that they find themselves in whenever they try to put their constituents first. And this is part of why I am in such awe of those few people, relative few people, who have the guts and the integrity to really do what's vital. And really, I don't care what party you're from. I don't care if you're with the Hopping Kangaroo Party. If, as a politician, you put your constituents first and you're willing to listen to them and their concerns, then you are truly living up to your oath of office. Otherwise, you're not. Now, you know, it's amazing. You listen to comprehensive reform, you listen to the lies, you listen to the nonsense, and then I keep thinking back to Nancy Pelosi, and I don't want to harp on Obamacare, that's not my issue, but I can't forget the image of Pelosi standing in front of that forest of microphones, the cameras running, and she had the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, the unmitigated gall to tell people, you won't know what's in this bill till after they vote for it, after you vote for it. I don't know if she was speaking to the members of Congress or the constituents or America in general, but what an outrage. I just want you to stop and let those words sink in again. You will not know what's in the legislation till after they vote for it. Would you buy a car that way? Would you buy a refrigerator? Would you buy a pair of shoes? Would you buy a necktie? There's a necktie in that box. Can't tell you what it's made out of. Can't tell you the color. Can't tell you what pattern it is. But you'll find out once you pay for it. Oh, and by the way, we can't even tell you what you're going to have to pay for it until after you agree to buy it. Now imagine that's a necktie, so maybe it'll wind up at the back of your closet. But now let's say a car, a house, anything of real significance in your life. Could you imagine buying a car, walking into a showroom, and the salesman says to you, you see that canvas cover, that big thing thrown over that lump in the corner of the showroom? That's your car. You can have it, but you have to sign here first and agree to pay for it. And only after you sign your name with the understanding that no matter what happens, you're going to be paying for this thing, then we'll put it in your driveway. Can't tell you what it's going to cost. Can't tell you if it's four doors or two doors. Can't tell you if it has a sunroof. Can't tell you the color. Can't tell you if it's got a good sound system or a sunroof. Can't tell you how big the engine is, whether it's a stick shift or can't tell you anything. But the only way that we're willing to put that car in your driveway is sign on the line, and then and only then will we reveal to you the true cost of the vehicle and what's in it. Who in their right mind would buy the car? And if some company tried to do that, I assure you that Pelosi would go out there, panging away on the podium and wailing, what kind of nonsense is this? But where it came to Obamacare, that's exactly what she said. You won't find out what's in it until after it's voted for. How in the world is this honor the democratic process that's supposed to be the hallmark of this republic? I mean, if you want to talk about arrogance, that was the arrogance. But in a way, I don't really blame Nancy Pelosi. No, I really don't. Because guess what? She continues to get reelected. These folks in Washington say the most outrageous things. When I was a kid, there was a program on, a guy by the name of Art Linkletter had a show, and it was called Kids Say the Darndest Things. And it was a very funny program. Well, you know what? Today we have politicians saying the darndest things, and nothing happens to them. There's no consequence. There's no consequence. Nobody says to them, you're fired. No one has the guts to pull a Donald Trump on Pelosi or any of these characters from either party and say to them, you're not representing us. We're going to get rid of you. They get reelected again and again and again ad nauseum. And you say to yourself, how in the world does anybody vote for the reelection of a politician who has the unmitigated gall to stand before the cameras, talk about a major piece of legislation? I read a statistic somewhere that the healthcare industry is the sixth largest in the United States. And think of what it involves. Think about how much we rely on healthcare. We rely on it the same way we do the fire department or the police department. This is about our lives. This is about our health and our safety and our well-being. This is about our children. It's about our families. This is really an integral part of who we are, what concerns us. And to have a politician dare to stand before the cameras and say, you won't know what's in this legislation until after it's voted on, and then get reelected, causes me to wonder if the American people are brain dead. Think about the level of arrogance that it took for her to issue that statement and the level of stupidity for her people to continue to vote to reelect her. And this isn't about partisan politics. I will remind you, I'm registered as a Democrat, but I think both parties stink. And this is a glaring example of the kind of a betrayal of the trust that we're supposed to have in our government. How do you trust somebody who says, you can't find out what's in this legislation until after it's voted for? Who in the world would buy a cat in the sack? So now let me ask you a question. If somebody has the temerity, the unmitigated gall, the chutzpah, to pull a stunt like that, how in the world do you trust them again? How stupid do we have to be as a people to continue to trust somebody who could do that? And I'm not sticking up for the Republicans, but let's be fair about it. Republicans went out and said, we are not going to allow this to continue. Now, I don't know why some of them voted for this train wreck in the first place, and let them explain it to their voters on Election Day, their constituents. But the point was they turned around and said, we need more time because people won't be able to sign up. They're going to lose their insurance. And think of how they were attacked by the Democrats. And now what are we finding out? The Obama administration itself is saying, give us more time. So the politicians who said, we're going to stop this before it gets totally out of hand, weren't wrong, like it or not. And I don't like government shutdowns, but what options were given to the politicians once they realized how screwed up things were? So here we are in a dysfunctional country that looks more and more like a third world country, and you almost have to wonder if that isn't what the politicians in Washington want. I really believe that Chuck Schumer and Alan Greenspan and people in the corporate sector, the Bill Gateses of the world, really and truly want America to look more like Mexico than the other way around. This is about a level of greed that I have never in my 65 years seen before. This is mind-boggling. Because, you know, if you look at what comprehensive reform would do, there's nothing good about the bill. Not for the average American, not for national security. There is absolutely nothing in that legislation that's redeeming. You can't point to one of the issues and say, well, this makes it worthwhile. It's a trade-off. We exchange this for that, and nothing is perfect. Look, nothing is perfect. Let's be very honest about it. But let's look at what comprehensive reform would do. Under comprehensive immigration reform, we would triple the number of high-tech visas. Well, if you're a company, that's great news. But here's the problem with the high-tech visas. Right now, Americans are being laid off at companies like Microsoft, like Blue Cross. All these companies that have computer programmers, IT departments, are looking to bring in people from India, not because the people from India are better than the Americans. I mean, some of them may speak a particular computer language, be fluent in a computer language that Americans don't have, but I tend to really doubt that. The problem or the situation is that Indians, people from India, will work for lower wages than Americans. And therein lies the problem. This is about controlling wages. And if you think that I'm getting it wrong, let me tell you, I'm not getting it wrong, because Alan Greenspan himself was the one who was behind it. It was Alan Greenspan himself who said that this is what we need to do. Let me quote Alan Greenspan. I think this is really very, very vital, if I can bring up Greenspan's. Now, this is something that what Alan Greenspan had to say when he testified for Chuck Schumer back on April 30th, 2009, when he went before the House, or the Senate, rather, the Senate Immigration Subcommittee. The topic of the hearing was comprehensive immigration reform in 2009. Can we do it and how? I mean, this has been going on for years. And some stalwart politicians are holding them back. Fortunately, they've been able to. I am fearful that this may not continue unless the American people wake up and start making demands on the politicians and saying, no, you must never, ever pass this kind of disastrous legislation, because first and foremost, it flies in the face of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. That should be the showstopper. Do you realize that they would have to deal with millions of applications from foreign nationals who evaded the inspections process in the first place, and that process was designed for one primary goal, to protect American lives and American jobs. If you go right to the immigration laws, and I enforced those laws, and I began my career as an inspector, you realize that we're supposed to keep aliens out of the country, and that word alien, by the way, is not a pejorative. It simply means any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. There is absolutely no insult in the term alien. What is wrong with the term alien for the open borders crowd, what I call the immigration anarchists, is that that word alien provides clarity to the discussion. And when you are doing a magic act, sleight of hand, three-card Monty, whatever you want to call the charade, the last thing you want is clarity. You want to obfuscate the issue with lots of smoke and mirrors and lots of deceitful language, and you want to lie through your teeth, because you know that if the American people had the truth, there is no way on God's green earth that anyone's going to vote for this train wreck. So, in any event, the law is supposed to keep aliens out of the United States, number one, who have a dangerous communicable disease. Ellis Island, for all the breastfeeding we hear from the open borders advocates and immigration anarchists, was really a quarantine station run by immigration and public health. That's why they put it on an island. Ellis Island was on an island so that no one got to the mainland unless the U.S. government put people on a boat and brought them here intentionally. And lots of families were still split up. If somebody came in with smallpox or tuberculosis, they did not get admitted. And so families had to make a tough decision. Half the family can stay. Half the family that's got the illness or the disease or whatever has to go home. If you wanted to stay with your loved one, you all went home. But there was no way they were going to let somebody set foot in the United States if it was known that they had tuberculosis or smallpox or some other dreadful disease. And that was done to protect the people who were here. That's why you have a peephole on your front door, folks. That's why they give you a doorbell, so you can make a decision as to whether or not it's safe to let a stranger enter your home. So let's get that out of the way. It also, the immigration laws are supposed to keep out aliens who are mentally ill, violent sex offenders. It's supposed to keep out convicted felons, bank robbers, rapists, scam artists, drug traffickers, gang members, gun runners, money launderers, all those terrible crimes, arsonists. It's supposed to keep spies and terrorists and human rights violators and war criminals out of the United States. And then it's supposed to keep aliens out who would become a public charge, meaning that instead of contributing to the economy, they would be draining money from the economy. And they're supposed to keep aliens out who would provide unfair competition for American workers, either displacing Americans or at the very least driving down the wages of American workers. That's what's in the immigration laws. Those are the laws that Mr. Schumer and Mr. Greenspan want to fix, because they want to eliminate this notion that we should not allow foreign workers to compete with American workers. They want the competition. They want the wages to be driven through the floor. If you think I'm kidding you, I'm going to let Alan Greenspan's statement speak for itself. These are Greenspan's words. Go to my website, michaelcutler.net. Go to capsweb.org. Go to the United States Senate website. You can watch the video of Greenspan saying this. I'm not making it up. He actually said this. And this was in addressing the reason to open up immigration quotas. So he said the second bonus for opening up immigration quotas on skilled workers, his words, would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled over lesser skilled. Skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. In the process, we have created a privileged elite. Did you hear that? Privileged elite. These are skilled American workers. This is what we refer to as the middle class. He calls them the privileged elite. But let me continue quoting him. We have created a privileged elite whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. Income inequality, not based on race, religion, ethnicity, gender, age. I would agree with that. Folks, he is speaking, Greenspan is speaking about opening up the quotas because he doesn't want much difference in pay for somebody who drops out of high school or has a college education, or has a PhD. Because to Mr. Greenspan, that represents income inequality. And he knew that he couldn't simply say we have to cut the wages of Americans, so he said wage premium. So for those of you fortunate enough to have a job, when you get your paycheck, do you have like a wage, and then there's a separate check or a separate amount that they say wage premium? Of course not. So what Greenspan is saying, his own words, not mine, these are his words, that we have got to address the increasing concentration, too much money, as he's saying, in this country, going to the highly skilled. And we need to lower the wages, forget wage premiums, we need to cut the salaries of Americans with an education. And, of course, he also goes on and says, of course, once we get more Americans who are educated, who is going to bother wasting their time and money on an education once you slash the salaries? The incentive for an education, increasingly an expensive education. You know, when I went to the City University of New York, it was free. Back then, if you had a decent average, you got into Brooklyn College, City College, Hunter, Queens College. There's a whole bunch of schools part of the City University. Still a great educational institution, City University, but it's hardly free. But when I was growing up, it was free. You paid a couple of $100 for a registration fee and literally a couple of bucks per credit. And that was the end of it. So anybody who was a good student, who was willing to make the effort, could have a wonderful education at almost no cost, and then you came out equipped to deal with the world. You came out equipped to have a successful career. The free education isn't there anymore. They keep on increasing the tuitions. Student loans look more and more like mortgage payments. And now you have Alan Greenspan really wanting to put the final nail in the coffin of middle-class America. And let's make certain that we slash the wages of the privileged elite. And how do we do this, folks? By comprehensive immigration reform. So comprehensive reform, answering Mr. Greenspan's call, his clarion call to go after those privileged elite middle-class workers, comprehensive reform would triple the number of H-1B visas. Those are the visas given to the computer programmers, the highly skilled. And for the first time, this has never happened before, under the provisions of comprehensive reform, Chuck Schumer's baby, Alan Greenspan's baby, Bill Gates' baby, this little baby of theirs, would allow the foreign families of H-1B visa holders to get employment authorization documents. Now, this is what you need to know about an employment authorization document. That card is as good as a green card, except it's only a temporary card. So for however many years that H-1B worker is here in the United States, his family can take any job whatsoever and compete with American workers on an equal footing. So let me give you an example of what we're talking about. Let us, for argument's sake, that there is a computer programmer who comes here from India. And by the way, if you wonder why I'm beating up on India, I'm not. According to the United Nations, according to the World Bank, India gets the greatest amount of remittances, money wired home by their workers working in the first world. Last year, India received over $60 billion in remittances. China came in second, Mexico came in third. With all the talk about the Mexican border, no one's talking about any of this business. You have politicians across the board talking about the need to bring in more foreign high-tech workers, people like Ted Cruz, and I listened to him say it when I was in Washington on July the 15th this past summer with the Black American Leadership Alliance. There was Ted Cruz on stage. We're going to secure that border, and we're going to bring in lots more high-tech workers to make America successful. Make America successful by laying off American workers? Make America successful by giving kids no way of paying off their student loans, even if they got the degrees in the high-tech fields? This is outrageous. But this is what the politicians are calling for, because this is what the Chamber of Commerce wants. This is what Bill Gates wants. In fact, Dan Rather did a report where he interviewed a woman who had worked for Gates. Here was a woman who was exquisitely qualified to do her job. She had previously been the vice president of a Wall Street bank. She had her master's or MBA in computer science. According to what she said, she was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate, came to work one day, and was shocked to find out she no longer worked for Microsoft. They handed her her package and said, here is your severance package. Here's a couple of boxes. Go clean out your office. You're out of here, and you don't even need to stay to the end of the day. Guess who replaced her? A worker from India. People from India will work for lower wages. So let's say we have a worker coming here from India, and let's say he really does possess a skill, whether it's fluency in a computer language or operating system, that is not available in the United States. And under those circumstances, absolutely, it's justified to bring in those foreign workers. That's fine. I have no issue with that. I think we should push to get more and more Americans fluent in whatever computer languages or operating systems so that they ultimately take the job. But as a stopgap, absolutely. This business has to be successful, and I agree with that. So let's say we have some guy who comes in, and he's got unique qualifications, which is why he's given that H-1B visa. But let's say, for argument's sake, he has three sons. They're in their 20s. They are all auto mechanics, and his wife is a baker. So let's say he goes to Dearborn, Michigan, because he's going to work in the auto industry, and that's where they need him to do the programming, and his kids go with him. And isn't that a hell of an oxymoron? Adult children. You got to love. Only in immigration do we wind up with this artful use of language. It's really, well, I shouldn't say only. I guess we see it throughout government and industry these days, but this kind of sticks in my craw. So these adult kids, just like the children of the DREAM Act who would be up to age 31, wow, there's another great one, right? But so these adult children come in, they're auto mechanics. Now, let's say, and I don't know what the numbers are, so I'm just throwing a number out, but let's say there's a couple of thousand unemployed auto mechanics in Dearborn. They desperately need jobs. They want to support themselves and their families. They're losing their homes to foreclosure. They show up looking for a job interview. Well, guess what? The children of that H-1B visa holder have as much right to taking that job as a mechanic as Americans who are desperate for the jobs. Now, if you look at the immigration law, Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, says you can't bring in foreign workers if in so doing they will compete unfairly with Americans. But guess what? Suddenly that doesn't much matter, because under comprehensive reform, it wouldn't matter how many Americans could do the job. What matters is that these folks have a card, and if they are discriminated against, then the potential exists that the employer could have a problem trying to explain why he didn't hire them. Absolutely unbelievable. So how does this help to get America and Americans working? Nobody asks that question, and nobody answers that question. Why is nobody on television talking about it? Why did nobody on television talk about how Infosys, an Indian-based company, committed visa fraud to allow aliens with visas that were not appropriate for taking meaningful employment in the United States were allowed to work? Infosys got hit by a $34 million fine, biggest fine in history, biggest fine. I went on the Internet. I didn't see any of the television networks cover it. Why is that? Why is that not news? But if some dolphin bit somebody on the nose, that would make headlines, okay? Some robber trips over himself running out of 7-Eleven, and the owner hits him over the head with a baseball bat, that will make headlines. But an Indian company commits visa fraud to the tune of $34 million, not a word to be found on television. Why is that? You draw your own conclusions. There is a narrative that is playing again and again and again. Illegal aliens just want to do the work Americans don't want to do. Tell that to the woman who was fired by Microsoft. Tell that to the guy who at the end of the rather interview talked about how he lost his job to Blue Cross, again, to somebody from India. These are Americans losing their jobs. We are admitting more foreign workers legally into the United States on most months than the number of new jobs that we are creating in this country. And now comprehensive reform would suddenly dump unknown millions of foreign workers into a labor pool that can't find work already. And according to the UN, this would also increase the remittances being wired from the United States to third world countries. Last year, over $200 billion got wired from the United States to the third world. And if you look at something known as the multiplier effect, when I was back in college too many years ago, we were told that it was a 1-to-5 ratio. Every dollar you put into the economy generated $5. Well, Cindy Pugh out in Minnesota was kind enough to arrange for me to do a 5-day speaking tour in Minnesota just a couple of weeks ago. And one of the people that attended one of the events, Cindy Pugh is a state legislator. She does a great job out there. And one of the people in the audience who was there when I spoke came up to me and said, you know, Mr. Cutler, we no longer consider it a 1-to-5 ratio. It's about a 1-to-3 ratio. He said, we've changed our calculations. And this guy is a longtime economic professor, and he's a senior fellow with a think tank, and he said, so it's really 1-to-3. So I'll take his word for it, 1-to-3. So if you take $200 billion, multiply it by 3, in essence, it sucks $600 billion out of the economy, almost 2/3 of a trillion, certainly more than a half a trillion dollars, effectively removed from the American economy. This at a time when our deficit is how high? Can we afford this? Can Americans afford to find more competition looking for jobs when Americans are out of work? I mean, nothing about comprehensive reform makes any sense for America or Americans. and nobody's asking the questions, and nobody on television is willing to have honest conversations about it. All they say is the economy would benefit. And let me tell you how screwy this is. I was at Briarcliff College a couple of weeks ago. My old buddy George Weisinger, who is a professor of sociology there. He used to be an immigration agent, then he went over to probation, then he retired, then he got his PhD, or I guess he actually got his PhD in his spare time, what little there was of it working for the government, but he's now a professor. And one of the pieces of material that the university provided us as we prepared for this debate was a report by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, and it was all about how comprehensive reform down the road would help the economy. It wouldn't be such a bad deal. It would be a good thing. Well, you know what was not in the report? There was nothing in the report about how it costs anywhere from 20 to 40% more to educate children who are not fluent in the English language. By the way, the source of that report was the CBO about 5 years ago. That report didn't show up. So no concern there about the impact of suddenly having more foreign students in the schools. Nothing in the report about remittances. The UN and the World Bank all say, well, if they pass comprehensive reform in the United States, more money will be sent out of the U.S. economy. Don't you think that that does harm to the balance of payments and to everything else? Of course it does. Where was it in this report that the CBO did? Nowhere. Nowhere. I mean, this is mind-boggling. So you look at these crazy reports, which are worthless. In fact, they're worse than worthless because people will look at it and say, oh, well, the CBO said everything is fine. No, it's not fine, but what was being done here was deceptive. How in the world do you do an all-encompassing report about the anticipated impact of comprehensive reform and totally leave out the remittances? There was nothing in the report about money being sent out of the United States by foreign workers. What kind of a report is that? I mean, if you want to talk about being willfully stupid and willfully blind, I think the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, gets the award. How in the world does this help us? The answer is it doesn't. It doesn't help us one bit. It would do irreparable damage. And this isn't about xenophobia, folks. This is about saying, let's make certain that the immigration laws live up to the primary reason that they were enacted in the first place, to make certain that we keep criminals and spies and terrorists and human rights violators out of the United States, and to make certain that we protect the jobs of American workers. How in the world is this unfair? How is this even a conservative issue? You know, I don't understand how in the world this has become portrayed as something that only conservatives are concerned about. These are American issues. Problem is the news media doesn't cover it. I watched the Greenspan hearing live back in 2009, and I sat at my desk with my laptop, and I wanted to put my fist through my laptop because I couldn't believe what I was hearing and seeing. I was so angry the next day. I had a radio talk show host, this very nice young lady, say to me, well, Mr. Cutler, what were your thoughts as you watched Greenspan testify? I kind of made a joke out of it, but I really wasn't laughing. And I said, you know, I was struck by the fact that I was witnessing a first as he testified. It was the first time I'd seen them allow somebody testify who was suffering from rigor mortis. The guy infuriates me. My own parents were blue collar. My mom came here ahead of the Holocaust, you know. I certainly understand the plight of people who are having a tough time. My father was a construction worker. He was a plumber. I remember those days when he came home without a job. And it meant that for the next 3, 4, 5 months, maybe we'd be eating tuna fish sandwiches. Hamburger was considered a luxury at that point. There are American families in that situation today. It's estimated that 1 in 4 Americans are now, 1 in 4 American children, that is to say, are living below the poverty line. But meanwhile, if you dare say that we need to enforce the immigration laws to do everything we can to get Americans back to work, you're branded as a xenophobe. I look at the websites, and they love to beat up on me. Oh, this guy Cutler went out, and he spoke at a Tea Party event. The Tea Party, of course, are horrible people. They're so horrible that they allow a self-avowed Democrat from Brooklyn to speak at event after event. I had some people actually ask me why I wasn't running for president. You could see the bigotry showing. I mean, this is outrageous stuff. You go on the internet and the accusations are flying like there's no tomorrow. But what's really remarkable is when they want to beat up on statements that I make, they'll say, well, Mike Cutler is involved with this group, or he was on a radio show sponsored by that group. But what they always seem to conveniently leave out is that I spent 30 years of my adult life enforcing and administering the immigration laws. The statements I make are not based on bigotry or racism. I'm a big fan of political asylum. When I was back in college, I participated in demonstrations. I was a B'nai B'rith president. We went to the White House. LBJ was the president at the time. And our goal was to get LBJ to convince the Russians to let Jews and other religious minorities leave Russia, come to America, or go to any country that would have them so they could get away from the tyranny of the totalitarian Russian government, the Soviet Union's government, and so they could practice religious freedom. I was delighted to admit refugees into the United States. It was always the high point of my day when they said, Mike, we have a refugee flight coming in. Give us a hand in that room. I was delighted because for me it closed the circle. And I didn't care what country they were from. I remember when Idi Amin took over in Uganda, the next day we were flooded with refugees from Uganda. I was happy to admit them into the United States. These people were scared to death, and it was a wonderful thing to see them here getting safe haven. But now we're finding out that the political asylum program is so flawed that we have been giving political asylum to terrorists. ABC News just reported on it. Brian Ross did an amazing job detailing just how dangerous this is. And it even involved one guy in Kentucky that we gave asylum to, affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and it's believed that he came here with the intention of killing an Army soldier, U.S. Army, who had served overseas in the Middle East. The immigration laws are not living up to their goal of protecting our lives or protecting the jobs of American workers. This isn't about being conservative. It's about being American. And increasingly, if you dare say that it's about being American, then, you know, all hell breaks loose and the accusations start to fly. And we need to push back. We need to make it clear that if we can't secure the borders and enforce those immigration laws, we're done. Stick a fork in us. And when I hear the Republicans say, well, what we really need to do, and this is outrageous, we're not going to give the illegal citizenship. Oh, no, we're tough. We'll just give them permission to work. You know, I got to tell you, those words are so startling that it blows my mind. You listen to it, and the brain can't comprehend what you're hearing. Why in the world are the politicians ignoring the 9/11 Commission report and the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel? Why are they ignoring the Real ID Act? The terrorists, in order to attack us, had to be able to embed themselves in the United States. And what does that mean? They had to get themselves identity documents so that they could hide in plain sight. And this is something that's being left out of all the conversations. Nobody is saying a word about it. Everybody is allowing this to go, and no one has the guts to stand up and say, what in the world are you talking about? I mean, this is absolutely stupefying. Let me read to you this. I know I've done this before, but I think this is so darn important I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to tell you what the latest Associated Press report about Mexico is, because I promised it in my email that I sent out earlier today. So we're going to get to that. But I want you to know that this is on page 47 of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. Again, not my words, their words. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted the bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, or SAW, after falsely claiming that he'd picked beans in Florida. Now, let me go to page 98. Again, 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. Not my words, their words. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. Is there anything in there that said that as long as we don't give these people citizenship, we're safe? Of course not. Of course not. And you listen to the drivel that passes for leadership coming out of the mouths of men and women who took an oath of office to protect and defend the country and the Constitution, who promised to their constituent voters that they would look out for them, and they are absolutely 100% oblivious to what's in the 9/11 Commission report. Can't forget 9/11. As a New Yorker, the ashes landed on my neighborhood, landed on me, landed on my home, contained the remains of my neighbors, along with lots of other people from all over the country, as it turned out. Those of us who were in New York on 9/11 are still suffering post-traumatic stress. I know all too many of the families who lost loved ones on 9/11. And you would think that there'd been no terrorist attack. You would think that there'd never been a 9/11 Commission report. I've testified before something like 15 hearings since 9/11. I did my first hearing 4 years before 9/11, ladies and gentlemen. It was almost exactly midway between the terrorist attacks of 93 and the attacks of 2001, and it was on the topic of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. And there is nothing in Schumer's bill that addresses the lack of integrity to the visa process or to the benefits program by which we give out identity documents. I want you to stop and think about that. The reason that the 86 amnesty was an abysmal failure, there were many, but fundamentally it starts with the fact there was never any allocation of manpower to actually enforce the laws. Man's laws, unlike nature's laws, are meaningless unless they are enforced. The speed of light is the speed of light because that's established by the universe. Man's laws are meaningless unless we enforce them. It doesn't matter what the speed limit on a highway is if there's no police officer standing there with a radar gun and a summons book. There is nothing in comprehensive reform that would address the findings of the 9/11 Commission. That ought to be the showstopper. When I was a kid, I did a little bit of single-engine flying. And you know, before you go up in an airplane, you pre-flight it. And I don't care what the destination is. I don't care how enticing the destination is. I don't care how beautiful the blue sky might look. If you pre-flight an airplane and you find it to be mechanically unfit anywhere, if you pre-flight immigration, you realize it's a failed system. How do we know? Well, we had the attacks at 9/11. We've had other terrorists arrested in the United States. But the fact that they were thwarted doesn't, you know, negate the fact that they got here. The best defense is a strong offense. And then you look at the Boston Marathon attack. The people that did it, the Tsarnaev brothers, it certainly would appear committed fraud on their applications for political asylum. It would seem that way. Maybe someone's got other information. I'd love to know what it is. But this was a family that claimed credible fear. If you send me back to Russia, I will be in deep trouble. That's what credible fear means. I will be persecuted. I will be arrested. I will be tortured. I will be killed. That's credible fear. And as soon as they got political asylum, most of the family members went back to the Soviet Union. What about credible fear? If they truly had credible fear, why in the world would they voluntarily return to a country where just months earlier they said, if you send me back, we'll be in deep trouble? Do you think maybe they lied? Did anyone look at that? So, you know, you look at this lunacy, and then you say to yourself, how in the world do we allow our own government to act against our own best interest and feed us this nonsense about how wonderful it would be if we suddenly gave unknown millions of illegal aliens? And by the way, they're telling us 11 million in 1986. Guess what? We were told about a million, maybe a million and a quarter, maybe a million and a third, maybe a million and a half. Nobody knows. We wound up with between 3.5 and 4 million. So now we're being told 11 million. Do the math. If the same ratio exists, we could wind up with well over 30 million. By the way, there was nothing in the CBO report about what that would do to the remittances, what that would do to unemployment, what that would do to the resources allocated for food stamps, unemployment, and the safety net programs. Labor is a commodity, folks. You know, the De Beers company in Belgium tightly controls the amount of gem-quality diamonds released onto the market every year. Why do they do it? To keep the price up. If every gemstone diamond was dumped into the market at one time, the price of diamonds would go through the floorboards. And by the way, if you do that sort of thing with a commodity in the United States, it's referred to as dumping, and I'm going to have to do a piece about dumping. Dumping is taking a product or a commodity and suddenly just dumping it, just, you know, barrels full, boom, there it is, to drive down the cost. It's an illegal activity. But comprehensive reform would dump labor on the U.S. market, and it would drive the wages through the floorboards. So Americans who are holding on by the skin of their teeth going to work, even if they didn't lose their job, would suddenly find that their bosses would very easily come up to them and say, hey, Charlie, we're going to keep letting you work for me, but you know what? I have so many people willing to work for half your salary. It doesn't make sense for me to keep paying you what I'm paying you. So either you're willing to take a massive pay cut or I will have to let you go. And you know what? Maybe the boss isn't wrong. Maybe that's, you know, he's doing what's in his own best interests. But certainly the American government isn't doing what's in its best interest. Because this boss, if he did that, breaking the law, you see, because supply and demand says if you have lots of a supply and the demand stays the same, the price goes down, way down. This would drive down the wages of the middle class and the working poor. And that's why when people say, well, we got to raise minimum wages, I don't know. At the rate we're going, most Americans will be earning minimum wage before comprehensive reform is done with because of the unfair competition. There are billions of people on the planet who would love to come to America and work for pennies on the dollar. And if they did, we would have a true race to the bottom. And when the dust settled, America wouldn't be America. The middle class would be gone. The American dream was inextricably linked to the middle class. So what we're witnessing is the willful destruction of the middle class by people like Alan Greenspan and Chuck Schumer and all those other advocates for comprehensive immigration reform. And when the Republicans say, well, we won't do it in one shot, we'll do it piecemeal, I wrote an article for CAPS, how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time. Does it really matter if they pass provisions of comprehensive reform individually or if they do it en masse? If the provisions are passed, the effect is the same. If I drive to California from New York, does it matter if I do it nonstop because I have another driver in the car and we just keep on taking shifts and we go directly there? Or if we stop over a couple times so it takes us a little bit longer to get there, but at the end of the day, we wind up on the West Coast? Either way, you get to the goal. And for Chuck Schumer and for the advocates for comprehensive reform, the obvious goal is to drive down the wage premiums. Think back to Greenspan's testimony. Schumer had to know what Greenspan was going to testify to before the hearing. That's how it works. I've done enough of those darn hearings. So this was no surprise. There was no shock. And then when they talk about we're going to make the Mexican border secure, kind of, sort of, a little bit. Well, we're a country of 50 border states. Any state with a seaport, pardon me, or an international airport is, in fact, a border state. But here is a report by a reporter by the name of Mark Stevenson, Associated Press. Mexican drug cartels are now making money exporting ore. And I'm just going to read the first two paragraphs because this is mind-boggling. Mexico City, Associated Press. Mexican drug cartels looking to diversify their businesses long ago moved into oil theft, pirated goods, extortion and kidnapping, consuming an ever larger swath of the country's economy. This month, federal officials confirmed that the cartels have even entered the country's lucrative mining industry, exporting iron ore to Chinese mills. Such large-scale illegal mining operations were long thought to be wild rumor, but federal officials have confirmed that they had known about the cartel's involvement in mining since 2010, and that the November 4th military takeover of Lázaro Cárdenas, America's second-largest port, was aimed at cutting off the cartel's export trade. How close is Mexican coming to being a failed state where the gangs, the cartels, are running industry as well as bribing the government? And this is on our doorstep. Now imagine the tactics. It's also about extortion and kidnapping. How secure should the border be against that kind of a pernicious situation? Again, the focus is not on national security here. The focus is not on what's in the best interests of Americans. The focus is clearly on satisfying the people with deep pockets who are making campaign contributions, because this is what they want. They want cheap labor. They want open borders, because to them, those borders are an impediment to ever greater profits. It's the old story of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. And I know that it gets tiring and people maybe are exhausted and saying, oh God, do we have to keep having the argument? And you know, that is the strategy of the open borders crowd, folks. It's a war of attrition. If we could wear down the Americans and if we could provide them with new toys, you know, new iPhones and new Xbox games and Dancing with the Stars, maybe the American people will just go away and let us do what we want and stop bothering the politicians. I hope this doesn't come to pass. There's only one America. And yes, other countries are certainly doing well by their citizens. Some are actually doing a lot better for their own middle class. But every country on the planet is impacted by America. America's ability to stand for peace. America's ability to stand for democracy. And time and again, we have witnessed this country taking hit after hit, and the wounds, for the most part, are self-inflicted. Inflicted by our very leaders that we've elect our best interests in the hallowed halls of Congress. We have a lot to be thankful for, but we also have a lot to be concerned about, folks. It would be a lot easier for me to sit home and not do this radio program every week. But I feel so compelled, having lived through 9/11 here in New York City, and having seen what I've seen as an agent, and having been involved with the kinds of prosecutions and investigations that I've been involved with, that I feel it incumbent on me to provide you with the benefit of what I've learned in my 30 years of working for the government. It is not anti-immigrant to be pro-American. And I can tell you that wherever I go, I meet plenty of people who came here as legal immigrants and naturalized, or their families did, and they are furious at the corruption that they see in our government. I've had people say to me, Mr. Cutler, I came here from China many years ago. I wouldn't have come if America was back then what it has become today. I can't tell you how many times I've heard similar remarks, and not just people from China, people from all sorts of countries, from Russia, who say to me, wow, I used to live under communism. I never expected to see myself living in a country that has no respect for our freedoms here. And that's where we are today. Increasingly, our freedoms are under threat, are under fire by politicians who seek to control the American people for their own gain. This is about unbridled thirst for wealth, power, and what's on the line is the future of America. What's on the line is the future of the free world, because America is the leader of the free world. And if we allow America to weaken itself to the point where it can no longer carry out its important mission as the freedom fighter of the world, if you will, I don't want to imagine the sort of darkness that could descend across this planet. We have an obligation as American citizens to take our citizenship seriously. And what that means is to be involved and to be aware. That's the purpose for this program, to try to educate you as to really and truly what the immigration issue is about and what other issues are about. Immigration is my area of expertise, but you know I do my best to bring in guests to share their perspectives on other areas of concern where they're the experts. That's what this program is about. That's what Americans should be about. Let's put down the game controller for a little bit. Let's step away from the TV, and let's write some letters to Congress. Let's make certain that the politicians understand that we're not as dumb as they had hoped that we are. And that's the work that all Americans must do. We live in a perilous era. And never more than today, our borders have never been more important than they are today. Our immigration laws have never been more important than they are today. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. I'm counting on you to live up to that saying that I always like to use at the end of my programs and at the end of my commentaries when I remind people that democracy is not a spectator sport. Indeed, it is not. In order for democracy to flourish and be secure, it requires participation by the citizens of that country. And this is something, folks, that we need to partner in. And this isn't about being a Democrat or a Republican. This divide-and-conquer strategy of pitting Democrat against Republicans isn't doing anybody any good. It's certainly not doing America any good. But it is paying off for those people who would change this country irrevocably. And we must not allow that to happen. So let's see in those who disagree with us, our neighbors, not adversaries, but allies who simply need to be brought up to speed, who need to be convinced that, in fact, where immigration is concerned, this is the number one threat. If we can't secure the borders, if we can't protect the middle class, if we can't safeguard the future for our children and our grandchildren, then what in the world is the point of the exercise? I thank all of you for once again joining me this Friday. This time it's November the 29th. I look forward to seeing you again, same place, same time, next week. But in the meanwhile, I hope you all have a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. I know many of you have a four-day weekend. I hope you're enjoying it wherever you are. I hope the weather is good, and hope things work out well for everybody. Speak to you again next week, folks, and please remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Good night, everybody.